From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, it's all movies, all the time. First, some troubling diversity news. While Latinos account for about a quarter of all movie customers, they only get a tiny fraction of filmmaking jobs. Then director Gavin Hood's new film, Official Secrets, tells the true story of a British intelligence officer who leaked a memo that shook the world.
She risked not only losing her job, but her freedom to follow her conscience. And there's something noble about that, I think.
And we'll look back at the summer box office, a tale of the haves and have-nots. All that coming up on The Frame. There are a lot of numbers in a new report about Latino representation in Hollywood. But here's one critical finding. Between 2007 and 2018, only 4.5% of all movie characters were Latino, a rate that stayed flat during that time, even though Latinos are more than 18% of the U.S. population and nearly a quarter of all moviegoers. The report is from USC's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative. USC's Stacy Smith and Benjamin Lopez, the executive director of the National Association of Latino Independent Producers, talked about the wider implications for this report and why Hollywood should care.
Well, what would happen if the storylines actually reflected the community? What would happen if you transported audiences to show them the multidimensional nature of storylines from Puerto Rico and Cuba and Spain and Mexico City? It's what I like to refer to as adventures in missing the point. There is an audience that is craving seeing authentic, nuanced, and compelling storylines. And I think that the studios are always looking for a return on investment. And right now, they're embracing the status quo. All we have to do is look and see what happened with Coco.
Remember me. Though I have to say goodbye. Remember me. Don't let it make you cry.
When you tell compelling stories and you put the production and the marketing costs behind them, audiences, Latino, and non-Latino audiences will show up and reward those storylines.
Benjamin, one of the things that the story points out is not just how few opportunities there are for Latinos, but how minuscule those opportunities are if you're a woman and you're a woman who's older than 45. I want to play a clip from a film called The Boy Next Door.
Look, Noah, I don't want you to think that any of this was your fault, okay? I'm the adult. I'm the one that should have...
Stop. Just stop. What we did wasn't wrong. No matter what you say, it wasn't wrong.
I wasn't thinking clearly, okay? I got swept.
That's Jennifer Lopez. And Jennifer Lopez, according to the study, is basically the unicorn in terms of women over age 45 who get a part.
It's to the point that every year we put together an award show, and we're always looking to honor a lifetime achievement. Every time that we're looking on the women, the Latina side, is so tough to spot. So I'm very thankful of this study because it's really highlighting it. And it's also helping us to look at this beyond anecdotal, because most executives would usually use, black films don't travel outside of the U.S. After Black Panther, it really changed the dynamic. Same thing with Coco and everything else. So now at this point, this data-driven type of solution that Nalip is able to bring to the table, we're able to say, actually, there's a lot more Latinas out there that are already 45, that are super talented and can take those type of roles and really, really represent our people in a really positive way.
Stacy, I think it's fair to say that part of the problem is who is creating the content. And you cite in your study how few Latino directors and producers there are. And then when it comes to filmmakers, this is a number that I found staggering. You looked over the course of these 1,200 films, you have 1,335 credited directors. There's one Latina woman. It's Patricia Riggan. She was born in Mexico, and she directed this movie in 2015. It's called The 33.
This is all the food we have left to keep us alive. We have to ration it carefully. If we plan on surviving down here until we are rescued.
That was a film about the trapped Chilean coal miners. And part of that directing study looks at another thing, that a lot of these directors are obviously men, and a lot of them come from countries other than the United States. Why are those numbers significant, Stacey, and how does that affect what gets made?
Well, I think that it's really important when we talk about female directors that we take an intersectional perspective, because often when Hollywood thinks female director, they're really thinking about a Caucasian woman. And one of the things that we were able to do in this report that I think is important is really talk about the pipeline. And we present some data from the Sundance Film Festival on submissions, both from U.S. filmmakers that identify as Latino, as well as international directors. And we see over the last 2 years, very few women in the director's chair are submitting to the Sundance Film Festival, which means that there needs to be funding, you know, philanthropic support, making sure that they have the resources that their white male peers seem to get access to, and getting those stories into festivals and on screens across the country.
I want to play a clip from a movie that, as far as I can guess, probably came about 5 votes short of winning the Best Picture Oscar.
Gracias. Ya dime.
No puedo. Estoy muerta. Oye. Me gusta estar muerta.
That's a scene from Roma where Cleo is saying, me gusta estar muerta. I like playing dead. That movie was a critical success, wasn't a global box office hit, but certainly did very well. When you think about signs for optimism, both of you, what are you excited about and what makes you feel that there might be change coming?
From my perspective, I really would love to see that Cuarón being an intersectional a Latina, right? Like being able to direct that from the U.S.-based perspective. I think U.S.-based Latinos have been really erased. I think that's also part of the study. However, there are several folks coming up in the pipeline that are getting greenlit. You have someone like Esteban Arango, who secured funding through Macro, and now he's going to make his film called Blast Beat, and it's about two Colombian brothers adjusting to the U.S. Those are the type of things that we want to see. I think even before the end of the year, we can actually have some wins on the table.
What I'm heartened about is there's so much organizing that's taking place around the study. And one particular initiative that is really trying to bring filmmakers together from the Latino community is this new effort called the Latinx House, to really be a place to congregate. And it's driven by Latinas. And it's really a community of filmmakers and creatives working together. It will inevitably birth projects, funders, to help quicken and change these numbers almost overnight.
Benjamin Lopez is the executive director of the National Association of Latino Independent Producers. Stacey Smith is the founder of the USC Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, which has just published the report, Latinos in Film, Erasure on Screen and Behind the Camera Across 1,200 Popular Movies. Benjamin and Stacey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, John.
Coming up next on The Frame, a new movie about a British intelligence officer who challenged the Iraq War, and it nearly cost her everything. Gavin Hood's new film is called Official Secrets. It tells the true story of a British intelligence officer who leaked an explosive NSA memo leading up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Keira Knightley plays the agent, whose name is Catherine Gunn. Hood, who directed and co-wrote Official Secrets, told me how that one memo sparked a global crisis.
Catherine Gunn was a young GCHQ British spy, GCHQ being the British equivalent of the American NSA, and meaning she works in signals intelligence, listening in to private conversations, hacking phones, hacking emails. You know, they're all sworn to secrecy under the Official Secrets Act, hence the name of the film, Official Secrets. And at a certain point, a memo sent by the NSA to GCHQ suggesting that they help hack the private correspondence and so on of UN Security Council members in order to see where they could dig up any dirt and perhaps persuade them into voting for the invasion of Iraq.
So this is somebody who's working under the direction of the George W. Bush administration, essentially asking operatives who are working in the Tony Blair government
yes.
to help not just drum up interest for the war, but make sure that people who might be on the fence in the Security Council are taken off the fence.
Yes. I mean, in this operation, if you like, took place on multiple levels. You know, these are smaller countries. As you know, the UN Security Council consists of 5 permanent members, and then you have 9 non-permanent members. And the non-permanent members at this point in time who rotate, at this point in time were smaller countries like Chile. And the idea was, if you can't get the French, the Russians, and the Chinese to vote for a resolution authorizing an invasion of Iraq, then you need to drum up support from the non-permanent members in order to achieve a majority. And if you can find dirt on their ambassador who's at the UN, and you might be able to lean on him a little bit and say, maybe you want to help us in this way. Because what Bush and Blair in particular wanted was a UN resolution for war the way we had in Kosovo. So that, you know, then there would be no need for the WMD argument, because we as a United Nations community decide that Saddam must be taken out.
The name of your film is Official Secrets. The name could be Shoot the Messenger, because what happens is that Catherine is charged. She's charged for violating the Official Secrets Act of 1989 that prevents everything that she has done. And the possible penalties are not insignificant. So before we talk about what happens, what is the threat to her legally? What is she facing, and how does she deal with that?
First of all, let's be clear. What she did was not treason. Some people would call it treason because we tend to throw these terms around. Treason is a specific act that attempts to bring down your own government and work for a foreign power. What Catherine did was breach the Official Secrets Act, which is disclosing secret information.
If you know anything or suspect anyone, it is your sworn duty to speak up. If you do not, and you are found to have withheld information of any kind, you will be charged with a breach of the Official Secrets Act.
So she's charged with breaching this Official Secrets Act, and of course, you know, she faces up to 2 years in prison for that.
Catherine Gunn leaked a secret document, and there's been a lot of conversation over the last couple of years about other people who have leaked secret documents, plural, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden. How would you place Catherine's story in the broader story of leaks, what purpose they serve, maybe what is a proper leak, what goes too far? Mm. How would you contextualize what she did given the broader question of leaking right now?
Julian believes, rightly or wrongly, in a complete freedom of information and no privacy, essentially, and dump everything and that'll stop everyone being corrupt. Catherine is on the other end of that spectrum. She leaked one memo and has never said or leaked anything else, nor, if you talk to her, would she ever, because she actually does not think that there isn't a place for secrecy of some kind. And I'll give you the perfect example in the film. She said to me when I was interviewing her, and it's in the film, I said, you're a spy. You hack people's private communications. You engage in dirty tricks. And now you're upset at being asked to engage in this dirty trick. What? I don't understand the distinction. And she said, Gavin, I have no problem gathering intelligence that might help prevent a terror attack and help my government prevent a terror attack. But I have a real problem gathering intelligence that my government uses to lie to the British people. And then I said, but you work for the government. She said, no, I work for the British people. Governments change. And when governments lie to their people, is there a point at which we as citizens should speak up?
By leaking information to try and stop a war, I'd argue that you chose loyalty to your country over loyalty to your government, your marriage, and yourself. You had nothing to gain and everything to lose. I think that speaks rather highly of you.
But that is what separates Catherine from Assange, is that she leaked one memo in a moment of conscience, risking not only her job, but her freedom. And that is not an easy thing to do.
We're talking with Gavin Hood about his film, Official Secrets. There's another comparison I'd like to make, and it seems a little bit far afield, but I'm going to make it anyway. And that is, we know of another very famous British spy. His name is James Bond, played by Daniel Craig right now.
Yeah.
That is a fictionalized version of a spy who basically jumps out of airplanes and does, you know, a lot of fighting and kills a lot of people. But it does feel like this movie is saying that there is a value to spying. It does have a role, but you have to understand what it is those people are doing, and you have to make sure that they are operating within limits. And that I think what Catherine is trying to tell us is, I will do my job and do what's asked of me, but there are some government. Places I will not go, and government doesn't ultimately decide what I believe is right and wrong.
There are two philosophical schools of thought, essentially, on what the role of the intelligence officer is. And I think most of us, and I'll speak to the first one, think of the role of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, in our traditional way, and has been run this way for years, is that the Central Intelligence Agency gathers intelligence from all over the place, from many other intelligence agencies, Department of Defense Intelligence Agency, military intelligence, and analysts analyze this intelligence. Walled in is their idea. Without political interference. And then they present the analysis for their intelligence to our elected leaders, and those leaders decide what to do with it. Now, what happened right before the Iraq War is a different school of thought came into power. When the CIA wasn't giving Bush what he wanted, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush set up the Office of Special Plans, OSP, under a man called Abram Shulsky. Shulsky's philosophy is different. Shulsky believes that the role of the intelligence services is not truth, but victory. Those are his words, not mine. Now, if your philosophy is that my job is to assist my commander-in-chief in achieving whatever mission he sets out for me, then truth has nothing to do with what we do with intelligence. Now, my job is a propaganda machine. In peacetime, we gather intelligence and we attempt to discover the best version of the truth of what's going on in that place, and we present that to our politicians. But we don't have them telling us what they want in order to justify a war. And those two philosophies were what were really at odds. The neoconservative Shulskys believed that, you know, bend the truth to achieve victory.
Your movie premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and it struck me there's another movie that played at Sundance called The Report, and it was about how the government tried to suppress the CIA's torture memo about how we treated detainees and how we tortured them trying to get information. And it feels to me that this could be a very interesting double bill. These two narrative films about true events, about how government tried to suppress facts that not only didn't make them look good, but also probably should have been shared because they said a lot about what the government was doing. Mm. And I'm wondering, taken together or just your film on its own, what do you hope people take away from looking back in history and seeing what happened to Catherine and seeing how government typically, because it happens in the case of Catherine, it certainly happened in the case of the CIA torture memo, tries to keep bad news down?
Two things I always want from these kinds of movies. One, I want my audience to be entertained and engaged and fascinated and wondering what's going to happen. But number two, after the movie's over, I would love them to have a really good conversation and debate. I don't want to preach to anyone. You know, you're absolutely free when you watch the movie to say, I think what Catherine Gunn did was wrong. But it might be very interesting to see her journey and her process of thought. We are not trying to stand on some soapbox and say these are easy things to talk about. They aren't. And in the end, what I think Catherine's story meant to me was many of us work for organizations, whether it be, you know, an accounting firm or one of the tech companies or whatever. When we see something in that organization that is corrupt or wrong in some way, do we have the courage to say, at the risk of losing our jobs, which is no small thing for most of us with families, this is wrong? And so, at the very least, what I would say about Catherine Gunn is she risked not only losing her job, but her freedom to follow her conscience. And there's something noble about that, I think.
Gavin Hood is the director and co-screenwriter of Official Secrets. Gavin, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, John. Great conversation.
Official Secrets opens on August 30th. Coming up on The Frame, the summer movie season is coming to an end with more of a whimper than a bang. It's Monday, and that's when we check in with our friends at Variety to see what's happening in Hollywood. Rebecca Rubin is a news editor at Variety, and she covers all things box office. So the summer movie season, I guess, officially ends Labor Day weekend, which is coming up. How would you grade it, or does it really depend on what studio you're looking at?
I think you nailed it. If you're Disney, you had three movies that all flew past the $1 billion mark, which is obviously massive. And then when you take a look at the other studios, they didn't fare quite as well. And that left the box office around 2% behind last year, which really just means that the last few months of the year are going to have to work in overdrive to make sure that we don't end up too far behind.
Yeah, because year-to-date grosses look like they're about 6% or almost 7% behind last year. And the summer revenues were equal to 2011, so not a lot of growth there, even though ticket prices might be higher. Are there any theories as to what is and is not working? Because when I look at the top 10 movies over the summer, and I'll start reading them, you tell me when you detect a trend. The Lion King.
Watch this.
You'll get it, Simba. Just takes time.
Toy Story 4, Spider-Man Far From Home.
Mr. Fury, this all seems like big time. You know, huge superhero kind of stuff. And, I mean, I'm just a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, sir.
I mean, obviously, those films did really well, but is it also possible that maybe audiences are getting a little burned out on all the sequels, prequels, and remakes?
This summer showed that if it's the right property, audiences will still come out and see it, but you had the X-Men movie Dark Phoenix, lost a ton of money, Godzilla King of the Monsters, and Men in Black International, which was a reboot as well. Those didn't, you know, do much to breathe new life into those franchises. And I think what studios were kind of realizing is if you're not adding anything worthwhile into the series to bring it back, audiences might not feel as encouraged to want to go to the theater and go see it.
The other thing that I noticed in looking at the summer, that while there were some original films that did okay, Quentin Tarantino's film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Elton John movie Rocket Man, and the Beatles movie Yesterday, there were some really good independent releases that didn't seem to get audiences. I'm thinking of two, Midsommar and Booksmart.
Let's go to Nick's party.
Are you kidding? No, no way.
We only have one night left to have studied and partied in high school.
Was it harder for smaller films to have a breakout this summer? Because it feels like there were some really good movies that didn't get much attention.
We definitely saw the indie box office struggle this summer. And last year especially, we had a lot of very successful counter-programming against these superhero movies. And this summer, we didn't see that work as well. And I think studios are really concerned that this highlights a bigger message, which is what does constitute a theatrical release. And that's something that they're having to grapple with because they were all very well reviewed. And for some reason, maybe it was the marketing, but people just weren't going to see it.
Yeah, I can see a movie like Midsommar doing what maybe Bird Box did on Netflix not that long ago and becoming really the talk of a streaming service, but it really didn't find a toehold in the summer. Is it possible, too, that Disney's dominance is hurting the other studios, that they're casting such a long shadow, it's hard for the Sonys and Warner Brothers and Universals to compete?
I would say yes and no. You know, if you have the right movie, I think audiences will still come out, even if it's not a Disney movie. You know, we saw Good Boys, a comedy from Universal, overperform over the summer, but Disney is certainly cashing in on, you know, the nostalgia factor, and they have some of the biggest brands in film. And so it's definitely making it harder for other studios to kind of shine.
If you look at the calendar, there's still a lot of really big movies coming out in the next couple of months. It Chapter 2.
Something happens to you when you leave this town. The farther away, the hazier it all gets. But me, I never left. I remember all of it.
There's a Frozen sequel and a Star Wars movie. Is it possible that the fall and winter films could reverse the tide and that 2019 could end up matching 2018? Or are we really too far behind to catch up?
It does look like there are a lot of promising titles. People are really excited that we're ending the year with a Star Wars movie. But last year, there were a lot of sleeper hits, and there were these movies that people didn't expect to make as much money as they did. And I'm thinking of movies like Crazy Rich Asians and The Meg. And so in addition to these blockbusters, we need some movies that people don't expect to do as well to really overperform.
Rebecca Rubin is a news editor at Variety. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for today. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.